Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to episode 498 with my guest, Jimmy Dore. This is a best of episode. It's a replay from our 15th episode recorded very, very early on, in 2011, our first year of doing the podcast. Our sponsor for today, as always, is BetterHelp.com, online therapy. I've been doing it for at least 3 years now, and I have a great relationship with my counselor, Donna. She is wise and encouraging, and I have seen a lot of growth since I started seeing her. And I love not having to leave my house to do therapy. There's something so awesome about that. So if you want to know more, go to betterhelp.com/mental. Make sure you include the slash mental part so they know you came from this podcast. And then just fill out a questionnaire, and if they feel that they have a counselor that is a good fit for you, they'll match you up with one, and then you can experience a free week of counseling to see if, I don't know why I pronounce counseling like that, to see if online counseling is right for you, and you need to be over 18. If you're between 13 and 17, they'll direct you to teencounseling.com, where you can get your parents to give consent and, et cetera, et cetera. Without any further ado, here is that episode with Jimmy Dore. Welcome to episode 15 with my guest, Jimmy Dore. I'm Paul Gilmartin. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour, an hour of honesty about all the battles in our heads, from medically diagnosed conditions to everyday compulsive negative thinking, feelings of dissatisfaction, disconnection, and that vague sinking feeling that the world is passing us by. You give us an hour, we'll give you a hot ladle of awkward Nikki. But first, a few notes. Please visit the website. It's mentalpod.com. If you would follow me on Twitter, that would be awesome. My Twitter name is mentalpod as well. And the fun thing about doing that is now when I'm interviewing somebody, I'm going to start tweeting, asking you guys for your fears. So when I do a fear off with somebody, I'll be able to use your fears and compete against the person. That'd be pretty cool. I recorded this episode with Jimmy Dore actually a couple of months ago before I started doing Fear Off, so unfortunately there's not one here. Take the survey on the website. That helps me get to know you better, and you can also look at the results and see how other people have responded. If you'd like to support the show non-financially, go to iTunes and give us a good rating. That helps boost our ranking and brings more people to the show, which we like. And speaking of the survey, in response to the question, if there is a God, what would you say to God? Responder number 614 on the survey said, "Man, did you fuck this one up?"
Everybody I know is bizarrely, beautifully fucked up in some weird way.
I couldn't stand you in the audition.
I couldn't stand you.
Yes, yeah. Awful. Yeah. I was drunk.
And I learned that I could solve my problems.
And said.
Through violence, since I couldn't communicate.
Lonely?
Yes. I'm afraid that my genitalia is ugly.
That's hurtful.
And what was your role in the robbery?
I mean, you never knew what you were going home to.
I had a jar that had teeth in it.
I was a wreck.
Other people's teeth?
Yeah.
I'm here with a longtime friend, Jimmy Dore. I'm glad you could find time in your busy schedule of getting high and making fun of right-wing people to come.
I make fun of left-wing people, too.
Well, you do, too. You actually get angrier at left-wing people than. But this is the one thing that I do know about this podcast is I want it to be apolitical. So we're gonna avoid talking about that because mental illness crosses all boundaries, Jimmy.
Well, okay. I mean, all art is political. Even a decision to not be political is a political decision.
Yeah, but my
I'm making a joke.
Oh, okay. Because I was going to say my intention isn't necessarily to make art with this podcast.
Okay.
If it happens to be, that's awesome.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So this is more of a news information.
No, it's more of a just something that feels good to me, and I hope feels good to other people, and makes them feel less alone.
Oh.
That's kind of my hope.
Okay,
I'm not really sure what it is. I'm kind of finding it as I go. But you and I have been honest with each other over the years. We've known each other 20 plus years, and we've always been pretty honest with each other about. What we're feeling about our foibles, our shortcomings, we make fun of each other, we make fun of ourselves, and you know that's one of the reasons why I enjoy your friendship. You were sharing a story with me the other night as you and your wife and I were walking to dinner, and kind of is there a way that you could give us a condensed version of this story? Because I think it might be an interesting place to start.
Well, I was talking about my neighborhood that I grew up in. That's the story you were talking about?
No, the one that happened a couple days ago. And then we'll get to your neighborhood. Because I think they're related.
Okay. I was packing to come to this comedy festival, and I'm standing in my living room. I live in Pasadena, just a couple of blocks up from down from the Rose Bowl,
mm-hmm.
Right by the Ice House Comedy Club anyway. And so I look out my window, and I see this guy just walk up my driveway, get in my car, open my passenger side door, and start going through my glove box.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't know what... instead of just calling the cops, I guess that's what you're supposed to do.
Right.
It just seemed silly. Like, I'm supposed to sit there and let this guy just go through my car and wait right. for someone else to show up?
Right.
It just seemed silly to me. So I went out there. I just went out there.
Uh-huh.
Those who fail to plan to fail. And I did not go out there with a plan.
Right.
And I didn't know what to do. I was just confronting him. So I come out. He sees me as I cross in front of the car, and he starts laughing. And he's about 25 years old and about 6'2", 185. And he starts to get out. He says, dude, I was just looking for a light. And then so long story short,
And what kind of energy did you greet him with?
I was swearing at the top of my lungs and, you know, what the F are you doing here? And
you can say fuck here.
Oh, okay. Yeah. What the fuck are you doing here? And motherfucker, get out of my neighborhood. And he's like, I went through his pockets to make sure he wasn't. And I was, you know, he had a stolen CD player from somebody else's car that he had in him.
Yeah, and you're assuming it was stolen, and I think most people would probably agree. Chances are it was probably stolen if he's looking through that stuff.
And he had a screwdriver
in
his pocket, which that sounds...
And he must not have been too hardened of a criminal because he's letting you go through his pockets.
Yeah, he was letting me go through. I was really like, wow. There was part of me watching me do it, like, wow, you're pretty ballsy. What are you doing? But the other part of me was like, well... If you don't do this, you're some. What are you? Not you're a pussy. You're not protecting your house, and you're not. You're gonna let this guy walk all over you. And what are you doing? Well, you know, I forgot that you know I'm not the guy I was 10 years ago, or even 5 years ago, when I used to be strong Jimmy. I used to be 5'10", 180 pounds myself, and which some people would say that's overweight. I don't. I was very happy. Look good in a suit.
Yeah.
And So I had...
How would you describe yourself now?
I would describe myself as shorter and skinny.
Okay.
I'm probably... I went from probably 5'10 to 5'8.
Uh-huh.
And
you had some issues with bone degeneration.
Yeah.
That was really, really trying.
Yeah.
I remember coming over to your apartment when you were in the worst of it, and it was hard to watch because you were in so much mental and physical pain from this.
It was unbelievable.
I can't imagine what it was like. You were in excruciating pain all the time, and they didn't know what was the matter with you.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. You find out that doctors will tell you. They'll do three things. They'll either tell you what they think you have. They'll guess, or they'll make something up.
Right.
Or they'll blame it and tell you it's in your head.
Right.
So that's they'll never just say I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. You should go see this guy. I don't know. And I found that out. But you know you don't. So anyway. So long story short. Again.
So that's how you lost the 2 inches.
So I had some height.
And you know, you have a little bit of arthritis. You don't move like you used
right,
to.
Right, right, right. So I don't. Yeah, I'm not myself. Right.
Right.
So I'm probably 35 pounds lighter, and
mm-hmm.
yeah, so I lost some bone in my spine.
Mm-hmm.
That's nice. And so in my head, I'm still my old self. And then this guy quickly realizes that he could overpower me, and he does.
Mm-hmm.
And he throws me down,
mm-hmm.
and I dislocate my finger,
mm-hmm.
and skin my knee pretty badly and hurt my hip like a son of a bitch.
Mm-hmm.
And as I'm down, I'm like, what am I doing?
Mm-hmm.
What am I?
You should mention too that up to this point you just kept shoving this guy and yelling at him, and not that he didn't deserve it, but it might not have been the smartest move tactically.
I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah,
but and then he took my phone because I was calling 911, and he goes around the corner and he throws it down. I just hear him go, "Your phone's right here." And as he's leaving, I can't believe the guy didn't turn around and run.
Hey, right.
Just run. You can outrun me.
And a criminal, but nice enough to let you know where to find your phone that he didn't ruin.
Paul, I'm like,
he could have punched you.
That's what bothered me. Yeah, he could have punched me in the face. I think he knew, though, that he might have had a record, and he knew if he got violent with me.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was thinking afterwards. I'm like, why didn't he? And why didn't he do that? If he's a big enough jerk to be going into people. So I'm like, why didn't he do that? And I'm talking about maybe he has already a record and he knows if he gets caught with another violent.
Yeah. My guess is that he's a little ashamed about what he's doing, and part of him wants to stop because he could have. Your phone wouldn't have added anything to it.
Right.
And he was nice about your phone, which makes me think he sounds like somebody that's maybe just kind of in over his head financially or something. Anyway, that doesn't matter. So continue. It's a puzzlement to me, though, what all this stuff that happened.
So that happened.
Yeah.
And that's the end of that story, right?
Right. But then we were talking, and of course I immediately have to be opinionated, and I said to you, and when you were pushing this guy and yelling at him, did you just picture your dad's face on him? You know, and then I apologized afterwards because I was like, oh, that was such an asinine thing for me to say. But I know your story, the childhood that you went through. Anger was people's tool for dealing with everything.
Yeah, I think that when I got in common, like in my neighborhood, I grew up in
Describe your neighborhood.
Southwest side of Chicago. It's a really blue collar neighborhood, and I think people would. It's kind of like Southie in Boston.
Yeah,
and so there's a lot of racism,
mm-hmm.
and I'll give you an example of it. So it's Democratic. They used to call it the Democratic Party machine in Chicago.
Yeah.
And it was always Democratic. And everybody in the city council was a Democrat.
Yes.
The mayor was a Democrat. Everybody's a Democrat. And then one year, through two white guys, people ran for mayor in the Democratic primary. And a third guy was a black guy, Harold Washington.
Yeah.
Well, the two white people canceled each other out, and the black guy won the Democratic nomination.
Mm-hmm.
So now we were going to have a black mayor because mm-hmm. it's a Democratic city.
Right.
Well, for the first time ever, everybody in my ward, in the 23rd ward in Chicago, 90% of them voted for the Republican.
Really?
Yeah. And remember Bernie Epton? You remember that?
Bernie Epton.
He lost. It was a close race. I mean, a Republican never got more than two votes for mayor in Chicago, right? Yeah. You know, there was always, like, so it'll be 12% of the vote every year. You get the Republican vote in Chicago for mayor.
Yeah.
And it was just like a token thing, and they would give him press coverage. But this time, he almost won.
Yeah.
And it was really close.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of...
Because Chicago is still to this day, especially the South Side, extremely segregated. There are neighborhoods where if you cross the street, all of a sudden you're in danger as opposed to the other side of the street. And
there was the 47th Street. It was the dividing line in my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. If you cross 47th, look, you didn't, you know, you got what was coming to you, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. And the I grew up in Homewood, which was more suburban, but mine was the first predominantly white community as you headed south. It was all African American until a half mile before mine.
Oh,
and
yeah?
It was literally on the other side of the tracks. And it was. And we grew up with this fear instilled in us that they're different, you know, it's dangerous, it's bad, and you don't know any better. So you and I were both raised in that,
you know, even
environment
in school.
until we began to hang around people that were different than us and see that it was a lie.
Comedy, I grew up on the South Side and everything on the North Side was gay.
Yes.
And, I mean, really, it was unbelievable. And to the point where it made it hard for me to perform in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
Because I would watch the comedians who went on before me and it would make me, like, you know, angry at them. Like, at the crowd for laughing at, and the whole, it was, they would just, I mean, I don't want to sit here and denigrate my neighborhood. There's a lot of great people in my neighborhood.
Right.
It was just how people react. How people react. They had problems with race in Chicago. They had scattered side housing.
Yeah.
And they would put it sounds good on paper, but it doesn't. It didn't work. I mean, it's just a hard thing to deal with. They're still dealing with it today.
Right.
So I'm not saying that there's anything in their DNA that makes them any different, reacting any different than anybody else would react. I'm just saying that was the reality I grew up in. There were dividing lines of neighborhoods between black and white.
Mm-hmm.
And there were, you know, I went to a Catholic school, and there was, there was a few black kids in our class, just a few, maybe three. And they weren't treated, none of us were treated that well, but they were certainly... treated a little differently.
And we should also talk about the police, the Chicago police, who don't have a history of being the most progressive. And while I'm sure there are tons of great people in the force, I'm just going to give you a couple examples of I had a friend who was a lawyer and had to deal with police a lot, and he said that they would refer to the blacks as shitskins. Police, who's supposed to be protecting the people. I got thrown in jail one time at I was underage. We were drinking outside a Blackhawks game, and we had to bail ourselves out of jail. And so we only had enough money for one of our guys to get out, and then he was going to go get more bail money for the rest of us. And it was at 35th and Wood, which is a tough fucking neighborhood.
Oh, yeah.
And he asked the white police sergeant how he could get back to his car. Could he walk to the stadium, back to the car? And the policeman laughed at him. And I apologize. I'm going to use these two words. But the cop said to him, laughing, "If the n**s don't get you, the s**s will."
Yes, that's.
But
I don't think that's unique to just Chicago.
I don't either. But a lot of people think once you get into a big metropolitan area, it's not the sticks, and there isn't that KKK mentality. Yes, there absolutely is. It's just it's in pockets, and you were raised in one of those pockets.
Yes.
That's what I'm trying to get to give people a taste of. It's a cosmopolitan city in many ways, but there are also these entrenched little islands of intense hatred and ignorance.
Yes, that is true.
But let's get back to the neighborhood. So you were kind of raised with this, just this, your tool for dealing stuff was just a big blunt tool of anger.
Well, it was,
am I wrong in saying that?
I didn't realize, I was happy, you know, I was lucky to be, I was I was healthy, handsome, and I had
still are handsome.
I had good parents, and so and I was athletic.
Yeah,
and I had a sense of humor. I think I don't know. I certainly developed it as a young age. You know, you are constantly wanting to be funny to get attention because I was.
Yes, you come from a family of
12 kids.
12 kids.
So I have 6 older brothers, right? So I was the youngest boy, and I couldn't beat them up or be a tough guy. But looking back at it, you know, I certainly was in a lot of scrapes as a kid, and everybody fought in my neighborhood. Everybody beat the shit out of each other all the time.
What was the name of your neighborhood?
You'd Vidham Park. Mm-hmm. You'd get in fights with people just because they were from another neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, and it wasn't a big deal. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, you know, we all played football, and we all, no pads.
Sure.
You know, tackle football, oh,
yeah.
No
yeah,
pads.
Yeah, so did we. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's crazy.
Yeah.
But we did it, and then... you know, I was on the wrestling team and all that stuff. I mean, we were men. We were, yeah. You know, and so when I get to Hollywood and I start to, or when I got in comedy and I start to meet these people who grew up on the north side of Chicago who are in comedy, and
right.
And they were really like to see that my energy really kind of scared them or could, you know, make them uncomfortable, put it that way. I don't know if it scared them. That might be
you
grandy.
Were, yeah, you were known as a hothead when I was when we were starting out. It was like, oh, Jimmy got in another fist fight tonight. He got in somebody's face because they wouldn't book him. I remember that. I remember you went after
R.
O'Donnell was booking the Improv, and oh yeah, Jimmy took a swing at him at Burton Place.
It wasn't
Jimmy
because...
took a swing at Pat Francis because something about a girl.
That's right.
You took a lot of swings at a lot of people.
Yeah, I wasn't afraid to take a swing at people. That's just how, you know, somebody does something to you, you confront them. That's how, I mean, or else you weren't a man. That's how I was so socialized.
And what do you believe today? Do you still think that there's an element to that? Because, I mean, it just happened last week, but were you just kind of in a moment of not really being conscious of it? Or was it, this isn't the right thing to do, but I don't know what else to do. I'm going to go ahead with it?
I didn't know what I was doing, obviously.
Okay.
I've never confronted a criminal before.
Right.
I didn't know. And I was like, I just wanted to make sure I was covering it. I was doing it correctly.
If you had to go back and do it again, would you have called 911?
Yes, immediately.
Yeah.
I would have called 911 right away. I would have just got a description. I went out there, got a description of the guy and said, okay, I know what you look like. I already called the cops.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not going to fight you.
Right.
That's what I will do next time.
Yeah.
I already called the cops. They're on their way. I know what you look like. Okay, I'll see you.
Right.
That's what I should have done.
Right. Well, that's good that you can see that, because for a lot of comedians, I think our choices in life for probably our first 30 plus years are driven by anger, sadness, loneliness, you know, whatever our demons are. We don't even think, we're so narcissistic, we don't even consider the world around us or the greater implications of what we're doing in the moment, because we're so driven by our emotions. We're so damaged emotionally in a lot of ways. Maybe I should just speak for myself.
Paul, I didn't have any awareness, and it was comedy that gave me that awareness of the kind of guy I was.
And your comedy is so different than it was when you first started out. You started out kind of just as a joke teller, but there was no soul to it. And sometime around, what, 5-10 years ago, you started taking on issues, kind of championing the underdog, and... I was blown away that you had kind of morphed into this comic with a conscience, which is not easy to do on the road where people just want to hear dick jokes. And you were up there talking about political stuff and kind of making a stand. And, you know, I take my hat off to you, because I know sometimes you were just saying the other day you watched Kyle Kinane kill, and he's a great comic.
He
tells jokes, and you had a
I was envious of him, because I'm like, oh, you know what? He's just having fun. He's just going up there, and he's just telling. And it reminded me of myself when I was at the Aspen Comedy Festival, and I was just a guy going up there telling funny stories about my life, and life was good.
Yeah,
and people wanted to be around me, and it was great. And then now I feel like some sort of burden, almost like I have to. I can only talk about things that matter all the time, and it made me think. It made me, like, watching Kyle Kinane made me think about what I wanted to do more.
Right.
And I'm not sure. I'm never sure.
Well, it's funny because you've built a career. You have a 1 hour Comedy Central special that airs.
Award winning.
Yeah, award winning.
Thank you.
I'm sure your parents gave you all the accolades you fantasized would have. And that's another thing. Let's talk about that.
We talked about, I had a reputation as a hothead.
Yeah.
It was through comedy that I became aware that I had anger. I didn't know I was angry.
Right.
And it was only through people reflecting back to me, and I didn't know I came off as a dummy.
Mm-hmm.
I think I had a very thick...
I don't think people could see your soul, because it didn't come through in your comedy,
no.
And it certainly didn't come through in all the bridges you burned in the fight you picked.
Right. No, right. I didn't... And that's why I think Graham Elwood and I became such fast friends, because we had the same temperament.
Yeah.
And it didn't, like, anger doesn't scare us.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make me uncomfortable. You know, yeah. If somebody's angry.
Feels familiar.
Feels very familiar, yes. And so my dad's dad was an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Were either
of your parents alcoholics?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No. So my dad did much better than his father. My dad was a good guy.
Did your dad ever get help
My dad never. You know, he grew up in the before any of that stuff. He didn't get help. He didn't even know what, you know, the guy lost a presidential election because he cried once. You know, I mean, but my dad was already a grown man. So, no.
Who lost the president?
Muskie. He was the vice president, remember, for McGovern. And he cried once because in public, and that was the end of it. So, no, my dad, the joke part I tell about it is my dad didn't drink at all. So, he had two emotions, angry and not angry yet, right? And because, you know, he didn't drink, so we never got to have any of those fun drunk times.
Right.
We just had all the miserable.
Right.
But that's not, I mean, my dad was just, he had 12 kids. He was a blue collar guy. He worked two jobs, sometimes three, to support everybody. And he did. He supported everybody.
Wow.
And then he managed to take a month vacation every year. A month. But that was, you know, when people used to get a month off from work. My dad was a cop, so he got a month off.
Now you get a vacation, it's called being laid off.
Yeah. You just don't go anywhere and you sit around and worry all day.
Yeah.
It's not really quick. But we were all angry, and we grew up in a time when people, it was normal to hit your kids.
Yeah.
It you know, because people had more kids. When you have one or two kids, you obsess on them, and you treat them more like real people, and you care about their emotions. When you have 10, 12 kids in a house, you don't have time to care about someone's fucking emotions. And you don't have time, you know, people always ask me, what's it like growing up in a big family? I don't know, because I didn't grow up in a small family, and I had nothing to compare it to.
Yeah.
But
I always fantasized about having a big family and thinking how great it would be.
They're great parts.
I had two. It was just me and my brother, and there was always a quiet. You know, I joke that my family was like the movie Ordinary People without the big laughs. You know, it was just kind of void of.
I had to remember that movie. That's why it took me a second.
Void of joy, a lot of tense silence, and when I would visit, because we had a lot of large Catholic families at my grade school, when I would go visit there, it was everything I wanted. There was noise, there was laughter, there was drama, there was fighting and yelling,
a lot of drama.
But at least there was something, and. There was also a dynamic, and I wonder if your family had this, the large Catholic schools, the Catholic families, that's where trouble was made into an art form, because the younger brothers watched the older brothers, and they were the ones that told us, oh, here's how you drink beer, here's how you smoke cigarettes, here's how you break into this, or you do that. So was your family, did you learn how to get into trouble from your older brothers and share it with your peers?
Oh, dude, definitely. We were all, you know, we all felt like we were a part of a criminal class.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you go to Catholic school and you're the youngest boy, you're a marked man, because I already had six doors go through in front of me, plus my sisters, you know, and they weren't all angels either. So, yeah by the time I got, that's why when I went to St. Lawrence, it was great because I get to make my own reputation. None of my siblings went to that school.
Oh.
So I got to make my own reputation, and it was it really made me, it was good, really good experience to do that, because I found out people could like me, who were an authority.
And why did you go to
still have a problem with authority today.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying sarcastically. Why did you go to St. Lawrence and your other siblings didn't? Were you smart?
I don't know why. My mom, I felt like I was smarter.
Because Catholic schools are not cheap.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I felt like I wasn't. My mom wanted me to go. And so I went. I took the entrance exam and I went. And I knew I was going to go to college. I don't know why. And so I was like, well, I want to go to college. I don't want to go to the public school. They weren't that good in my neighborhood.
Right.
So
let's talk about depression a little bit, because anger is so closely related to depression. You know, there's a saying that depression is anger turned inwards. Do you feel like you're somebody that has depression?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you talk about it a little bit?
Yeah, I didn't know. It runs in my family, and I didn't. Of course, they didn't bother to tell me that until I was in the middle of a major depression. And I was like, well, it could have helped me out if you had told me this.
Who had it in your family?
It run, you know, aunts, uncles. My dad had it. My old, you know, sister.
And did any of them get any kind of treatment for
and
it?
My sister. I had an older sister who did. And
How did the family view that? Were they didn't feel any kind of shame or look down on her or think, you know, you're
no,
weak?
No, she had some hard, my one sister had some hard times, you know, so she was always a little more unstable than everybody else.
Yeah.
And we always kind of looked out for her and worried about her and what have you. And but that's just because she went through a depression at a younger age than the rest of us, I think.
How is she today?
She's born again Christian.
Yeah.
And she doesn't take any meds and... She had some tragedy in her life. She had a daughter who died.
Wow.
Yeah.
And does it seem like she has found something that helps her?
Yes.
In
her religion. I have a niece also the same way. She was bipolar and hard to medicate and always having episodes. And then she found God and she's born again. And that seems to do it for her. I don't know how that does seem to do it. I think it's, you know, I know what me... That it's my anxiety that leads to depression.
Mm-hmm.
Like I get into worrying and anxiousness about the future. I live in the future or the past. I'm either living in fear of the future
or regret
about
the past.
Well, can I talk? And those are two really fun places to be.
Yeah, there is such a link in my mind and a lot of other people's between depression and spirituality. You know, there is a depression that no amount of spirituality can cure, you know, a physical depression, but there is also, I think, a situational depression that spirituality is the only thing that can cure in my mind.
Well, it makes me, you know, it's kind of like, I mean, I wish I could go back and, you know, not... And I wish I could be religious, but I can't.
But I don't think you have to be religious. No. I think you probably got a feeling when you started doing your material that meant more to you. You probably got a little bit of a feeling of peace and self-worth when you started talking about things that you thought maybe might just make the world a tiny bit better. Am I wrong?
Paul, let me just put it to you this way. My life... has exceeded my dreams in many ways.
Yes.
And I still manage to be miserable most of the time.
Right. And yes. I get the sense that maybe there is something in you that is wanting something that's maybe not good for you. That is just going to make you want more of it.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm finding that out. You know, like I didn't plan my life past an hour special.
Right.
That was it. That was my goal.
Got it. And you were probably happy for a little while, but now it's what next,
well,
right?
Well, I thought, I didn't know there would be a what next. It didn't dawn on me. I thought, like, you know, it's like Brett Favre. I don't want to win a Super Bowl. Once you do, you're like, okay, well, whatever happens after that, I'll be okay. I already won one.
Yes.
And that's how I felt. But I still have the rest of my life to live now. It's like,
right.
I can't retire and announce comedy.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Which is what I want to do.
And you have a gift, so why should you?
So,
you know, hanging around with you at this festival, so many people have come up to you and just gushed over your podcast and how much they love it and your radio show, and yet you are still have this deeply unsatisfied thing in you.
It's rotten. There's a you know, they say depression is anger at the self, right? So I noticed that again only through working with other people that I'm hard on myself. I just thought that that's how you, I guess you internalize stuff from your parents, right? And but it wasn't just my parents, it was my neighborhood. You know, and I talk about how there was physical discipline in people's houses in my neighborhood where I grew up, but you'd go to school, they'd hit you in church. Depression is anger at the self.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And don't you think most comics...
Have you tried therapy?
Yeah, it's hard to find a good therapist. They all seem just as screwed up as me, and nobody seems...
What's the longest you've ever stuck with therapy? With a single therapist?
I don't know, maybe 6 months.
Okay.
I saw this one guy. He was all right.
Yeah.
But they're all, you know, I had one psychiatrist. She would fall asleep. She'd fall asleep
really?
Every time.
Really?
And her eyes would kind of start to close, and I would go, Pamela, what are you doing? She goes, no, I'm thinking. I'm like, you're not thinking. And then, you know, like, I was really in depression, so it took a while for me to be able to talk back to her. And then, like, the third time, and I just go, Pamela!
No!
And I go, she goes, huh? And I go, I'm gone.
Wow, that had to be really hurt.
And she wanted to do an episode over, we're going to do an episode of Jimmy's Therapy. And the next episode.
It's an all new Jimmy.
And the episode of Jimmy's Nuts.
Yeah.
She wanted to do our weekly therapy. She couldn't be in the office. She wanted to do it over the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And I hesitate. And she was like, no, I've done it before. It's okay. I'm like, okay, well, of course. Of course, right in the middle, her phone cuts out. Right, of course, of course. And then got to get her back. And I'm just like, what the?
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know how that
happened. You got to try a different therapist.
Yeah.
Because there's good ones. There's really good ones out there. Ones that have really helped people find what they need.
I can't believe, Paul, since a young man, I don't know why I was always a seeker. Wayne Dyer and Deepak Chopra. Oh, but it all started with Leo Buscaglia. I used to see him on PBS.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got interested in that stuff. And there's a lot to that. Like, if you can focus your thinking, it's all about being able to focus your thinking. But it's amazing that all that knowledge hasn't helped me.
Because it's not about knowledge. That's the thing that took me 40 years to realize is there's... You know, there's the physical world, there's the mental world, and then there's the spiritual world. And the spiritual world is completely unconnected to intelligence. And trying to reach that through intellect is a dead-end street. And it's why
that's why the smartest people in the world can build nuclear bombs.
Yeah, exactly.
It really is, right? It's why Christopher Hitchens can defend the Iraq War, right?
Yeah.
That's what that's about. So yeah, so that's why I was just talking to somebody about that movie, The Matrix, and they were saying how it ruined it for him that Keanu Reeves was the central character in that. And I was like, no, that makes the movie. And they're like, how? Because it shows you that you're not going to reach enlightenment through intellect. You're only going to reach it through courage.
Wow.
And that's, he didn't have intellect. He wasn't dumb. He's a
right.
dumb. And he isn't even a good actor.
Yeah.
But, no, I think he's a good actor.
Yeah.
But it was, to me, that's really, it's a metaphor for, even that guy that they're like, oh, don't you think the studio made them choose him? Well, even if they did, it was a happy accident for me.
Yes.
Because, yeah, there could have been a more interesting actor in that role, but I like the fact that he's kind of dim-witted.
Yes.
And that's not what it takes to save the world.
It's
intelligence.
It's not. And the most
courage
courageous
and
the most courageous act to me is to say, I don't know and I need help. Those are the two most courageous things that I've done in my life, and they've been the most beneficial to me. And I wonder if that isn't maybe where for you to reach the next level of finding who you are or what you need to be happy, that might... Because I believe there is a matrix. That's funny that you mentioned that movie. I feel like there is this matrix to the universe that guides us, that helps us do what it is that we're meant to do if we can get to the point where we get out of our own self-will and try to see what it is. But only by connecting to other people like you and I are doing right now can we begin to see, have that matrix reveal itself. Does that make sense?
Yes. I was going along just fine, figuring things out. And then I realized that, the way to feel fully... Joseph Campbell says, they asked him what the meaning of life was.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, there is no meaning to life. There's only the meaning you give it. And that people aren't looking for a meaning to life anyway.
Mm-hmm.
What people are looking for is the sense of having been alive.
Yeah.
And that's why people take drugs and ride roller coasters and see scary movies.
Yeah.
And for me, it's because those things throw you into the present. And when you're in the present moment is when you feel the most alive. But
yes.
It's the hardest place to get to.
It is.
And I just, you know, I just thought of that myself. Like, well, that must be why people like roller coasters and people like scary movies. Because you aren't thinking about anything else.
Yes. And why we like stand-up comedy.
And why we like stand-up comedy, because I'm right there.
Yeah.
And it's the best for me when I can... not drop my preconceived ideas of how I want the show to go, but how I can let it kind of unfold instead of forcing it. And that's the hardest thing in the world for me to do. I love to hide behind my jokes.
Yeah.
I love, and that's why going up the other night at that show, you know, really scared me.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to do it, but if
can you talk about that?
Yeah, so I was on this show, and it was all people from Chicago, and I was going up last because I had the most credits.
Mm-hmm.
And but these guys were doing this kind of comedy that is very raw and edgy, and it was a long show. So by the time you get up there, they've heard a lot of comedy, and they've heard some really over-the-top, raw, edgy things. And so now anything I say is going to sound kind of silly and trite, and so it's hard to be that different and still get bigger laughs than everybody else. And in my mind...
Mm-hmm.
I always, be careful what you wish for. I always wanted to be the guy. I always wanted to be the headliner on the show. I always wanted to be the guy that people came and listened to. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, oh, shit, now I got to be funny.
Yeah.
Now people expect me to be funny. Before, it used to be with Gray, I used to surprise people.
Yeah.
Used to be able to open for other people. And people are like, oh, did you see how funny that other guy was that we didn't expect anything? Well, now when you're the guy, boy, is it, it's fucking different, man.
Yeah.
And it's a, it's and,
And that's the thing about living in the future is you get this idealized version of how things are going to be.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get any of those details. So you think, I'm going to go last. You forget the checks are going out while you're up there when you're headlining. You forget you're following a better comedian than you were when you were the middle guy.
Yes.
All these things. You have to do more radio in the morning. You have to. There's all these responsibilities that come with it. And that's one of the many dangers of not living in the present moment is you get that double-edged sword of fantasy. You know, the fantasy allows us to create these great creative lives for ourselves, but it's this also this terrible thing when we misuse it.
Yes. Yes. How did you feel about that show the other night? I mean,
I thought you did great.
I meant you.
Oh, my set?
Yeah.
I didn't go up with much in the way of expectations. I weaseled my way out of going up last. I was originally scheduled to go last, and I
have a TV show.
I haven't done much straight stand up in a while. Just done my character.
You did the gay stand up.
Yeah, that's right.
They're a better crowd.
Yeah, and and I didn't feel like I would be the funniest person, so I said, "Can you put me up earlier in the show?"
Oh, okay,
and I wasn't the funniest person in the show.
You're very funny.
Well, thank you.
You're very funny.
But I was a little insecure about going.
I think everybody was insecure.
Yeah. And you followed a guy who was very, very drunk and was getting very, very graphic. And it was, I would have been a little pissed off if I were you. And you were pissed off and you vented a little bit. And it was right on the edge of appropriate and inappropriate. And that was what was edgy. So you were, it's funny because you were edgy. Mm-mm. And yet you didn't lose your composure. Mm-hmm. You lashed out a couple of times. It got a little uncomfortable where it was like, oh, is Jimmy going to have a fucking meltdown and start yelling at people here? But you didn't, and you ultimately kept your composure, and it was cool. And I was so glad when you went up to the guys who were you were kind of snapping at from on stage and kind of shook their hands and laughed with them afterwards.
No, you know what, Paul? Before I went up, I actually, you know, while... I was angry at him for making it hard on me. I wasn't angry at him for doing what he was doing. Because if I wasn't going up, I would have been enjoying the shit out of it.
Well, this guy was...
So I told him that when he came off stage.
Yes. Oh, okay.
I go, hey, thanks for making it hard for me. That was great, you motherfucker.
Oh, okay.
And so I went up, and that was more out of like that. I was like, yeah, I would never in a million years ever take you on the road with me.
Right.
Or, but I would have enjoyed this had I not had to follow you.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's how I felt. So I wasn't... It was more out of like you... Prick made it hard on me, and and he was very graphic and very raw, and he was actually drunk.
Oh, he was hammered,
which put it in another so there was this excited uncomfortableness during his set too. So it was like there was a heightened emotionality about his set that I couldn't
repeat.
I knew that
or top.
So now where do I go with that? And now I got these young comics,
but you
who've heard my name since they started comedy,
right.
And now they get a chance to see Jimmy Dore, and they're gonna see if he can do it or if he's gonna fucking fold like a house of cards.
Now, see, and that's such a sick way to look at it because I'm back there thinking, Jimmy is way wittier than this guy, and he's way more honest than this guy.
Oh, really?
And you brought that, and that's ultimately what great comedy is.
Oh, okay.
But I would have been in the same headspace you are, because when it comes to us, sometimes we're the worst perspective we have, because we are filtering everything through our low self-esteem and our past.
Yes.
You know, somebody said to me one time, I was having a bad day, and they said, I wish you could see yourself through our eyes. And it made me start to cry, because I was like, wow, I am really hard on myself. And I think most artists really are. And that's why we have to go into the fantasy world, because it's too painful to deal with the reality of the present moment and how we feel about ourselves.
Well, I always try to tell myself, if, you know, it's very easy for whatever reason, and I think it's mental illness, that, you know, your day-to-day becomes not special to you.
Yeah.
And I think it's, if you, you know, a technique I try to use, doesn't always work, is to try to think of myself at my first open mic. And if someone would have handed me a sheet, my resume from today,
you'd have shit yourself.
I was like, that's going to happen?
Yeah.
You're kidding. I'm going to be on first name basis with Norm MacDonald?
Right.
Are you kidding me? You know what I mean? I just, it would just blow my mind, you know? Yeah. And it's hard to keep, that's like I may make that joke, you know, if my life has exceeded my dreams many times over and I'm still managing to be miserable. And that's, and you know, I thought about that the other day and I was like, well, I really have to change that.
Yeah.
I have to, so I guess I'm at that age when people go through that stuff.
Yes.
I'm 45.
Yes.
So I'm like trying to reevaluate, you know, maybe get a new wife.
Jimmy's kidding, of course. No, lovely wife, Stefan.
I love my wife. Yeah. We just got married last summer.
Yeah.
She's great. But I'm actually starting about thinking about starting a family with her. I'm like, you know, I never thought. It's so funny. Comedy is such an unstable life. You never. You always think that. I always think, you know, they say guys don't think about raising a family or starting a family until they feel secure in their career.
Right.
Well, you never feel secure in your career as a comedian. Until you have a television show.
Right.
And that's what I always think. Like, well, I'm like, well, yeah, I'm going to have kids as soon as I have a television show.
Mm-hmm.
What a crazy way to live your life. And no one told me. There's no one, you know what? Maybe I'll write a book on how to, for young comics or young people getting to Hollywood. This is what, don't wait till you have a TV show to start a life.
Right.
Start a life.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, I don't know. You don't have kids. I don't have kids. And now you don't have kids because you're dead inside a little, or
yeah.
Okay, me too. And
it's never been a something that my wife and I really wanted badly. I have moments where I think, oh, I'm really missing out, but they're fleeting.
Fleeting. But it's when
I'm too selfish. I'm not making a joke.
Yeah, but it changes you. That's the point.
But I don't want to find out when the kid's three, I don't really like this. I'm sure the chances are 99% that I wouldn't. But my dad was that way. My dad had kids that he wasn't interested in. And he wasn't present. My dad could never really reconcile himself to be comfortable in his own skin. And when you're not comfortable in your own skin, I don't think you can be present for your kids. And so I would say to you, wouldn't it be good for you to become more comfortable in your skin before you pull the trigger on having kids, so you could be really present with them?
Because
when you're in the future...
Yes, Paul. I mean, on paper, yes, that makes sense. But as we all know, they say if you wait to the right time to have kids, you never will. And so,
I think that's more true financially than it is emotionally.
I don't know. I don't even know if we might not have her still not do it. I don't know. But it just seems like, it seems like I would have half a life lived. Like, that seems like such a big thing. Like, you know, I'm starting to look for meaning in life, because comedy, while it does bring meaning to my life in a certain way, it's not enough anymore.
No. It's a compartment. It's not.
This didn't do it. Didn't do it. Like, I did it. I did it. I guess, you know. That thing that.
Yeah. Maybe it does. Maybe it does bring you that perspective. I don't know, because I don't have kids. I wonder what.
I'm tired of thinking about myself all the time.
Yeah, it's such a dead end street, and that's where we think we're going to find the answer, but we don't. I found through connecting to other people, that's the only way I can ever get gratitude in my life and get the perspective that I need. You know, Joseph Campbell, I'm glad you brought him up. He said something when we decide, and I'm mangling it, paraphrasing it, but basically in a nutshell, he said, when we decide to do something for the betterment of society, for other people, something altruistic, magical guides will show up to assist us.
Yes, thousand tiny hands.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Is that what he? Is
all
that,
the doors yeah. were open. One and door I, closes, and mm-hmm.
and I completely that agree.
Is, I've experienced that. It is amazing. So that makes me realize that we are actually not separate. We are all connected.
Yeah.
So there's that kind of spirituality. But I wanted to make one more point.
Except Filipinos, they're not connected.
I'm not sure. There's some Samoans I can certainly exclude, but. So when I was on this path and I realized that through emotions, through not being afraid of emotions and not being growing up in that neighborhood I grew up in, it makes you only comfortable expressing certain emotions, you know?
Yes.
Joy, anger, rage, and more rage. And so those are the things that you can cheer for a team, you can laugh, you can be angry, and you can fucking punch someone.
Yes.
And that's it. But then I realized, emotion, connecting to people, that's the way.
And showing vulnerability. That
being vulnerable, yes. Oh, being open, yes.
That's where real intimacy begins to me. And I have been afraid for most of my life because I was afraid it would put me in a weak position. But it does. But that people love when you approach them with vulnerability.
Yes.
Most people.
Yes.
Because
you're right.
Then they can let their defenses down. But it's the scariest thing in the world, and it goes back to that courage that you were talking about.
Well, I want to say this, because this is about mental illness. So my first depression, when it happened, I didn't know what it was, and it came out of nowhere.
How long ago was this?
This is 1999.
Yeah.
And it was more, and it started with
Was it based on the Prince song?
Yeah. And I had the anxiety. I had the anxiety. That's what really led to the depression. And so
describe the anxiety, if you would.
It's just everything. Nervous about things about I wouldn't be nervous. And then a tightness in my chest that I can only describe as a million-pound tourniquet being turned against my chest that was constant. Constant.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it. Like, there's nothing. I couldn't believe my bones were broken. So, but what happened, the consequence of that is it made me scared to open up, to feel emotions again, because I was afraid I was going to go crazy.
They were going
to
kill you.
Yes. So I've been
fighting that. So what did you do? You shut down?
I've been fighting that ever since.
Yeah.
And I've had two depressions since then. I had one in 06, 07, and then currently.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, and I'm sorry if I come across as an asshole for bringing this up, but you're my friend, and so I want to say it. Do you think smoking a lot of weed is good, given that you have that?
No.
Okay. So what keeps you from giving up the weed? You don't know anything better to bring
I just
bring the-
keep thinking it's I'm going to turn a corner.
Yeah. And
No, I'm noticing now. No, I've cut back. I've noticed that, when you... I quit smoking pot one time for my first depression for 2.5 years. I didn't smoke pot and touch alcohol or caffeine because I did not want to feel that again, ever again, right?
And so what was that like?
That was, I wasn't on the right meds, so I was just...
Do you take meds currently?
Not anymore. I'm going to go back.
Okay.
Because I'm figuring out now that I have ADD, which can also lead to depression, which I think is what I have.
Yeah.
And which you don't know, I never noticed I had because I was a comedian, and you don't have to do a lot of tasks. You have simple, your life is simple but complicated in other ways, right?
Right.
As a comedian, the flaws didn't show. But now that I'm having to produce two shows by myself, write, produce, edit, get
You're a busy man.
It is really my, it's showing. It's showing
You're up. Starting to feel the chest tighten, or?
The ADD is showing up. I'm missing stuff all the time and falling through the cracks, and I can't manage my life is becoming unmanageable.
Yes.
So I'm like, I have to get, and then I talk
to... It's too bad there's not a program for people that can't give something up and their lives have become unmanageable. I'm making a joke. The first step of a 12-step program.
Oh, no, it's not the weed. Yeah. No, it's not
It's not related to the weed.
I don't think so, Paul. I mean, if it was, like, it's not like I could... I don't think so.
Yeah.
But no, now that I'm anxious, I can't smoke pot like I used to. I can never smoke before. I used to always smoke before my shows.
Yeah.
Because it helped me.
Which blows my mind.
One time I performed high,
I got such cotton mouth, my upper lip stuck to my teeth. Mm-hmm. I ran out of water, and I couldn't remember what my next line was until it was uncomfortably awkward, and then I would remember. So it was this half hour of just jolting, lumbering. Oh, so awful. So I don't know if I should say my hat is off to anybody that can perform Stone, but I don't know how you do it.
It had to be at a certain... It's all about headspace. I was at a club that I didn't want to come back to.
Yeah.
And so somebody had offered me some pot, and I would always say no, because my biggest fear is I'd have a bad show, and people go, oh, Jimmy was high on stage. That's why I had a bad show.
Right.
Well, this club, I didn't care. I don't want to come back. So I got high and went on stage. It was the best goddamn show I ever had in my life. Wow. And that's because I was comfortable and I didn't care. But if I was going up in a nervous situation and I was high, it would be horrible.
So what about trying to find a way of living where you can go up sober?
I go up sober all the time now.
And have that same relaxation, because that is possible.
Yeah, well, that's what you got to figure out.
And I don't mean sober in every aspect of your life, but just for that.
Yes.
Just for that show.
No, yeah. I mean, I don't really need weed anymore.
Yeah.
On stage. It doesn't. Yeah. I can get there without it.
Good.
I know I can remember. Good. I can remember how I need to be in my head to be there.
Right.
That's all.
Yeah. And, you know, I've probably said this before on the podcast. I'm not anti-alcohol, anti-weed. I'm anti that for me.
Yeah.
But if other people can use it in moderation and it enhances their life, God bless you.
It did for a while. Well, let me ask you this, though. Did you find that about what I mentioned about, you know, you're afraid of I'm afraid of emotions. I was afraid to open my heart to a woman.
Yeah.
And I was never, like, to me, I pushed, like, I was on a freight train of opening my heart until my depression.
Yeah.
Like, I was everything open, big. I was, and my life was expanding, you know, and things were really, and it was, life was rich.
Yeah.
And then when the depression hit, I just shut down and I was afraid to do that. And did you have that experience?
I didn't know how to. I didn't understand that there needs to be emotional intimacy before there can be physical and sexual intimacy with someone.
Mm-hmm.
I just learned this in the last 2 years. And the biggest aha moment for me came a couple of months ago.
On a submarine?
On a submarine. I was going through this health issue that was, and I had gone off my meds, and I was miserable. I was listless. I was depressed, and I was having to be on this diet where I could basically only eat vegetables. And my wife was kind of questioning the way I was going about this diet. And I wasn't really being fully honest with her about how much pain I was in. And my initial instinct when she questioned what I was doing, because I was going to buy a food processor so I could start making myself more soup, which is one of the things they recommend. But it's, you know, it's like $400 or something for this food processor. And I wanted to buy it, but I knew that she didn't really think we needed it, and she was questioning about my diet, and the old part of me started to come up, and I was about to go into, I'm going to win this argument, and I had just started to learn how to be vulnerable, and instead, I broke down, and I cried, and I told her, I'm so tired of feeling the way I'm tired, I'm confused, I'm scared. You know, and she gave me a hug, and she went online and she bought me the food processor, and I immediately started getting healthier. And it showed me that and somebody, and I shared this with someone, and they said, that's where intimacy begins.
Oh,
and I've
really?
Been afraid of that my whole life, because for one reason or another, I wasn't shown the tools how to do that as a child. I didn't see it happen in my family. So vulnerability was a scary thing to do, but I'm learning how to do it now. And the energy that I'm greeted with in this podcast is an excellent example of it, blows my mind, and it brings me such peace and happiness. And I think it encourages other people to do it. You know, there's people that go on the message boards and are opening up about things that are happening with them, and they're sending me emails. And it's just, I've never been so high on life as I have been since I started doing that thing a couple of months ago, that vulnerability, which used to scare the fuck out of me.
Really?
Yeah. And my marriage is starting to become healthier. Not that it was ever bad, but it was lacking something that I knew that it wasn't good. Yeah, the word was out.
It
was lacking something, and I knew it was my fault, but I didn't know. And so I had to, you know, start to get some therapy for it and ask for help.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. And it's a good thing that Carla's parents, you know, raised her to, you know, embrace weak men. I mean, hats off to you. My wife was raised Mexican. She's not. She wouldn't put up with that shit. She was like, keep trying to get what you want, pussy. That's what she would say.
Stefania, your wife, is one of the sweetest, most gentle people that I know. She is obviously Jimmy is kidding.
She's a mama bear, as Sarah Palin would say.
Yeah,
she gets very protective of me.
Yeah, I love looking at her face when you are performing or doing something. She just beams. She just beams, and it's such a beautiful,
oh really,
such a beautiful thing to see. Yeah, she is just a really, really positive, sweet person.
This episode is sponsored by When Breath Becomes Air. When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi is the exquisitely observed memoir of an idealistic young neurosurgeon attempting to answer the question, "What makes a life worth living?" as he deals with his own terminal cancer diagnosis. It's a stunning reminder to live while we are alive, a must-read for anyone in medicine, from a doctor-turned-patient. For healthcare workers, expand your view on patient care and the fragile beauty of our mortal lives through Kalanithi's unforgettable words. Some of the questions Kalanithi wrestles with in this book include, what makes life worth living in the face of death? What do you do when the future flattens out into a perpetual present? When the future is no longer a ladder towards your goals in life? What does it mean to have a child, to nurture a new life as another fades away? When Breath Becomes Air is a number one New York Times bestseller, Pulitzer Prize finalist, and named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review, People, NPR, The Washington Post, Slate, and more. When Breath Becomes Air is available wherever books are sold. Learn more at prh.com/breath.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And yes, I was very lucky to meet her. I remember it was a really nice story. When I was in Los Angeles, I had just gotten out of a relationship with a woman who didn't have the courage to find out who she was supposed to be.
Yeah.
And that's why that's one of the things that, anyway. And I was lonely, and I wanted to find a woman who I could share my life with. And I went to the Acme Comedy Theater one night, and I saw this girl on stage being hilarious. And I was like, why can't I just be with a girl like that?
Mm-hmm.
See, look at her. She's dark like I like.
Mm-hmm.
She's funny.
Dark as in personality or complexion?
No, complexion.
Yeah.
She's dark hair, and mm-hmm. and she's Mexican.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, I just love that. I don't know what it is. It just gets me. And she was funny, and you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought she was Italian.
Mm-hmm.
And which is, she makes a joke about that in her life. She goes, whenever people meet me, I'm 100% Mexican, but when people meet me, they think I'm Italian because, you know, they like me. and we didn't get together for probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 years after that, maybe mm-hmm. 5 years after that, we didn't hook up. And it was great. I was like, oh, and I love to tell that story. Like, oh, it's a good feeling for me to remember that, seeing her, and now that's my wife. And
you know what's so funny? You just described Carla and I saw her on stage 3 or 4 years before I ever asked her to go out, and she's Italian.
Really? You thought she was Mexican?
She's not a dirty Mexican, Jimmy. That's the point that I'm trying to make.
I remember the first time I saw your wife on stage.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, I never saw somebody work a pole like that. I couldn't believe it. I was like, wow, she's so tiny, but she really is sure of herself.
Yeah,
I remember the first time I saw her on stage at the Comedy Womb. I remember what she was wearing.
Yeah.
She was hilarious. Yeah. I couldn't believe
mm-hmm.
that a girl could be that funny.
Yeah.
I'd never seen anybody, you know, almost, she was the funniest person I'd probably seen up to that point, I think, live.
Yeah.
She was amazing,
yeah.
And she doesn't perform anymore, which I miss.
She always hated performing. She just liked writing jokes. Made her very nervous to perform. She doesn't like to be the center of attention. She will not be on this podcast because for one, she's not mentally ill, other than the fact that she chose to live with me.
Yeah.
But she shies away from that kind of stuff. But Let's go on this note. I think you and I are both pretty lucky to have found the patient women that we have.
Yes.
And, you know, I'd be interested to know what people think about some of these subjects that we brought up on the podcast. So if you're out there and you feel like going on the message boards, go to mentalpod.com. That's the website for this podcast. And is there anything you want to plug before we go?
I have a website, and go to my website, jimmydorecomedy.com.
And Dore is spelled D-O-R-E.
Correct. Yeah. And then I have if you like The Daily Show, Paul and I do, a radio version that Paul is on,
mm-hmm.
called The Jimmy Dore Show,
mm-hmm.
and that's how I describe it. Is that a good
description? That's succinct. It's probably, descriptor. Probably makes it sound like it's a knockoff, which it's really not. It's just a kind of a comedy political pundit show.
Yeah.
Kind of a humorous left, right, and center, but
yes.
But more lefty than anything.
And then I have a podcast where I interview other comedians called Comedy and Everything Else, along with Steph, my wife. And those are the two things.
Yeah, great. Well, I want to thank you for coming on, and it was great getting to know a guy I already know.
Okay.
Getting to know you a little bit more, and thank you for opening up. And if you're out there and you think you're alone, you're not. You are not alone.
I think I'm going to send you guys off with an excerpt from survey responder number 640 to the question, if there is a God, what are some of the things you would say to God? He said, pretty good job overall. Next time, try to make people a little more compassionate and small batch whiskey a little cheaper. I can't disagree with that one. Also interesting to the question, do you have any comments or suggestions to make the show better? He wrote, I've only heard a few early episodes, so I'm not sure if Paul has gotten more comfortable with podcasting, but I did feel at certain points that he could stand to let his guests talk a bit more freely. It did occasionally feel like he was steering the conversation to reach conclusions he had in mind. Overall, it didn't hurt the quality of the interview, and I'm totally still a fan. I just felt that occasionally Paul was getting in his own way. I think there's a lot of people that would probably agree with you. And you're not the first person who has sent me that email, so I will try to keep that in mind and try to not let that gnaw at the center of my skull as I lay awake tonight staring at the ceiling. I am not alone. Thanks for listening.